Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here in the Nerd Party Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lee Hutchison, and joining me is the man behind the Uncut Gems board game, Dallas King. Welcome back, Dallas.
This is how I win.
I mean, A24 Hour News, it's another week in lockdown, but the news this week has been a little bit closer at home. Dallas, you've had quite the eventful week. Do you want to talk us kind of through your exploits and how you yourself have managed to insert yourself into A24 Hour News?
I believe, I think the term the kids use these days is gone viral, slightly. You know, not thousands upon thousands, but enough to certainly have an evening of my phone beeping all night. But what happened was, you know, as we are on lockdown, and one of my favourite shows, Parks and Recreation, is the famous Cones of Dunshire incident, where Ben Wyatt is on sabbatical between jobs and spends his time creating a fantasy board game called the Cones of Dunshire. And I was looking to do something similar and had an idea for a board game based on Uncut Gems. And it would be kind of like Monopoly, where you would go round and you have to go around the board hitting various spots, and you're trying to get $155,000 in order to bet on Game 7 of the NBA semifinals and KG. Now, it wasn't just a board. I didn't just design the board. I went the whole hog. I did the rules. I've got chance cards. I've got betting cards. You know, if you place a bet, you then either pick up a card and it either says, that's the dumbest fucking bet I've ever heard, and then you lose, or you, this is how I win, and you win the bet and you win your stake back. And then all these chance cards about if you find Phil and Nico find you, then you lose everything you've got. But, you know, Julia might get a tattoo of Howie on her butt, and therefore, you know, you gain $10,000. I've worked out everything, you know, and I posted it up online on, I think it was Thursday night, and sort of tagged a few people. Nothing really happened for about a day, and I was kind of like, oh, I thought somebody would have said something, you know, even just in general on Twitter. And then on about Friday afternoon, after like a work call or something, I then found that my phone had about 20 plus notifications. I was like, what's this? And it turns out that the Safdie brothers had shared it on their Twitter feed. And I think the rest, as you say, is history, I think.
Are you going to get like that Safdie Brothers tweet, like put on a mug or a mouse mat, something like that?
Potentially. I mean, I rewatched Ingrid Goes West today, and at one point I think she, like her first feature on Taylor's Instagram feed, she sort of prints out and then puts in a little frame. So yeah, no, I might do something similar, I think. I'm still waiting for, you know, Alara Pictures and the A24 project to be in touch to discuss licensing the game, you know, get me on board and getting a cut of those gems, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It was incredible to see, because you put so much effort into it. I've seen some of the behind the scenes teasers for a few weeks, mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this has got a bang. It's the attention to detail is unbelievable. So I was so happy to see that you got the recognition from the Safdie brothers and some random, you know, it was quite amusing to see the random people that were liking it kind of across the world. Sometimes I would have a wee look in the like list and go, oh, that person from that thing's liked it and stuff. It was great to see the Hollywood elite combining with your magical skills.
Yeah, no, there was so many different sort of languages and stuff, you know, sharing it. And I'm assuming it was along the lines of everyone else who was like saying, I need this game in my life. You know, how much are you making another one? Obviously, I don't have the rights because it's not my film. Someone suggested I even sort of go on Etsy or do a Kickstarter or something and just rename it something like, you know, Unfinished Opals or something like that, and have an Adam Sandler lookalike, you know, stand in for photos and stuff like that. I'm not sure if it'll ever get to that stage, but it was nice. And on Instagram, I know that Julia Fox and Wayne Diamond, former guests of the show, liked the post and stuff like that, and Wayne actually commented on saying it was really cool, so that was nice as well.
I think we can probably call Wayne Diamond a friend of the show now and stuff. We've had him on, he, you know, boosts our content, he praises you. I think friend of the show is now applicable to him.
Yeah, alumni or no, we'll go friend. I like that. Yeah.
And Julia Fox has had another fantastic week on Instagram. I don't know if you saw her question and answer session the other day.
I did see highlights of it, yes.
Yeah, she has kicked someone in the balls, but she did get paid for it. So let's hear it for the working women.
Yeah, wasn't there also something else that, like, the last thing she does at night is she prays, and then a couple of questions later she's like, oh, I love shrooms, and it's like...
Yeah, she likes shrooms because of they're from the earth. I don't think she was the biggest fan of acids, and I think she said as well that she likes to go to sleep or sleeps with a hairdryer that is switched on as well. So so many questions.
Yeah. I think we'll leave that one there.
Absolutely. Well, next week, you know, A24 Hour News, we're obviously short on the ground, but we can preview next week's interview, which is with David Lowry, the writer-director of A Ghost Story and the upcoming Green Knight. So here's a little mini preview of that bumper interview. One thing I did not expect at all, like, I loved the trailer, and then when I went to see the film opening weekend, what surprised me and caught me completely off guard was the scope of the film in terms of how much time it covers. I didn't expect that and anticipate that, and I thought it just made this film so special. Where the periods in time that sort of we see this ghost through in terms of the future and the past, were they always set in stone, or was there sort of multiple ideas about how far in the future it could go, what the future might look like, or how far into the past it might go as well?
It was pretty set in stone. I didn't really, improvise too much there. I was like, we'll go to when this plot of land was first developed as a domestic environment. You know, the first time someone laid out for a house on this tract of land. And, you know, some vague period in the American West felt like the right time period for that. And it made sense that no one would have built a house earlier than that. So we started there. And then going into the future, there's always, like, you could always go further. You could always go to, like, the decimation of the world, the stuff that Will Oldham actually talks about in his monologue. But it didn't need, you know, it would have been out of balance if we had just kept going. So I just was like, let's go to a Blade Runner future. And luckily Dallas has a pretty futuristic skyline already. And Weta Digital did some enhancements, added some buildings, added a little flying car to it. But it's downtown Dallas looks kind of Blade Runner-ish, it turns out. And then, you know, we added more, that was an area where we added some stuff, like some pickups, like the stuff of him walking around the office building, and we filled it in a little bit just so it wouldn't be quite so big of a jump. We wanted to take a little bit of time getting to the future, but nevertheless, all of that stuff was pretty much in the script.
So there we go. David Lowry will be joining the show. Currently guest on the show. Hopefully one day we can put him into the friend of the show category. So fingers crossed.
Absolutely. I've had a sneak peek of that interview, and he sounds like someone that I think I would get on with, and I want to be friends with. So yes, we need David Lowry as another friend of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Tune in next week to hear what he thinks of the Star Wars prequels. I know that's exactly what everyone tunes into this show for. So in this episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the A24 filmography, and we're getting closer and closer to the end of it, the less that they're putting films out. And we'll be discussing Gloria Bell and High Life. And so first up is Gloria Bell. So Gloria is a free-spirited divorcee who spends her days at a straight-faced office job and her nights on the dance floor, joyfully letting loose at clubs around Los Angeles. After meeting Arnold on a night out, she finds herself thrust into an unexpected new romance filled with both the joys of budding love and the complications of dating, identity, and family. So written and directed by Sebastian Lelio, adapting his Chilean film Gloria. When did you first catch Gloria, and what was your expectations going into this adaptation?
I first caught it end of last week, It's one which I'd missed at the cinema for some unknown reason. I don't know why. I think when it finally was released over here, I think it was maybe on at my local independent cinema for about a week, maybe on split shows off date, and then, yeah, just fate conspired to mean that I missed it. So I was just waiting for it to, and then I was going to watch it live for the podcast, and then it turned up on Netflix, I think just like a couple of weeks ago, maybe beginning of April, so it was perfect timing. I mean, I'd heard sort of good things from it. I know it was the surprise film at Glasgow last year, but I watched it and I enjoyed it. You know, it's not going to be, you know, knocking on the door of my top 10, but it's certainly not going to be knocking on the door of my bottom 10, I think it's fair to say. What about yourself?
Yeah, I caught this as the surprise film at the Glasgow Film Festival, so I think me and everyone in that room expected it to actually be High Life that was shown. And then when the credits start to roll and it was Film Nation, I was like, ah, it's definitely not High Life. So I was kind of pleasantly surprised that I was expecting one A24 film, but at least I got another. And I'm a huge fan of Julianne Moore. I remembered sort of falling in love with her as a 10-year-old, seeing The Lost World Jurassic Park. And I've kind of continued to be real impressed with her. And, you know, in the past few years, it doesn't feel like she's been in the, you know, the big, she's not got the exposure that she's kind of deserved. So, you know, I think we all know how poor Hollywood can be at giving roles to older women. But I think she's fantastic here as Gloria. I left the film thinking, like, probably the same as you. It's like, I enjoyed that. That was fine. I kind of, last night, I actually watched The Bling Ring again. My girlfriend wanted to watch it. She'd never seen it before. And I kind of think of sort of Gloria Bell and The Bling Ring as being kind of very similar films where people are just sort of just kind of essentially going around their day-to-day lives. A bit of drama happens here and there, but it's very kind of, you know, it doesn't go anywhere too dramatic. Everything kind of just unfolds and you just sort of see these characters going around their day-to-day lives, and that can be sometimes just quite nice to watch, just maybe especially sort of in lockdown where there's not much for us to do, and sometimes just watching someone go dancing and then go to a you know, paintball range and then have some dinner with some friends, you're like, yeah, that's kind of seems like as adventurous and as exciting as any sort of Star Wars film. So yeah, I quite enjoyed it. It was nice to revisit again. One that I think so, a right down the middle film, but one that I thought was nicely needed right now.
Yeah, no, this is one is very much more of a, like you say, a sort of slice of life or sort of character study. There's not like a huge sort of narrative drive towards any particular sort of crisis or big event. You know, I mean, you've got the central relationship between, you know, you watch this film and then you realise it's actually Maud Lebowski and the Jesus who are having this affair, not really an affair, but a relationship. And, you know, he's got this other life, you know, his ex-wife and kids who still rely on him for sort of financial and emotional support. And that causes the issues in the relationship where she feels that he's not able to give her the full attention that she needs and deserves. And that's where I'd say the most of the emotional sort of drive and crux of the film comes from, you know, whether or not that's enough to sustain, you know, the sort of just under 2-hour runtime. But one thing has to be said is that this film has an absolutely banging soundtrack, you know, probably up there as one of the best soundtracks for any A24 film. Not score, but soundtracks, you know, it's, you know, disco classics all the way. And you know, you were just waiting for one particular song to play, and of course they would end with that particular one.
Yeah, it was a really good soundtrack. The kind of the two times I've seen it, I've kind of proceeded to walk out of the cinema listening to the score, and then the other time I think I watched it and then I sort of had some dishes to do, and there's me sort of like in the kitchen just like scrubbing the dishes going, Gloria, Gloria. So it was, yeah, it really kind of hits the spot there, and I thought that was definitely one of the high points of the film. Well, I'm curious as well, like this was, you know, first watch for you recently. Have you seen the original Chilean film Gloria, or would this sort of inspire you to go check it out?
I haven't seen the original, but no, I certainly would go and see it, because I think this is the same director who did A Fantastic Woman as well. So I think I'm a fan of his work. So I definitely probably would go back at some point and check out the original. But I mean, this is a film which I probably would have caught anyway, regardless of the A24 project, because, like, you're a huge fan of Julianne Moore. Certainly, I mean, she really sort of came to my attention in sort of Boogie Nights and Big Lebowski. I mean, she actually has a very sort of blink and you'll miss it role in The Fugitive, speaking to Harrison Ford, asking him about medical charts and stuff like that back in sort of 92. But yeah, no, she's been one of, like, America's best actresses for the last sort of two decades, and someone who we need to see more of, because I think I haven't really seen much of her beyond sort of her Oscar winning role, sort of Still Alice, which I think was around about 5 or 6 years ago now. So yeah, and it was always a delight to see her on the big screen, well, small screen, since we're at home.
Yeah, the one thing that did somewhat frustrate me, because I really enjoyed A Fantastic Woman, I sort of loved the colour and the style of that film. This reminded me a bit more of one of his most recent films. It was a sort of North London Jewish lesbian drama, Disobedience. I found this film personally a little bit largely quite on the drab style in terms of the visual direction. Obviously, I've only seen three of his films, but when you kind of knock it out of the park, like with Fantastic Woman, this just sort of felt like anyone could have done it. I didn't really think there was anything particularly interesting about the direction. The cinematography didn't overly appeal to me. You know, it was more interesting some places when they'd maybe gone to the nightclubs or in Vegas for a little bit. But yeah, I just found it to be a bit of a frustrating one.
Yeah, I mean, it could have perhaps been a conscious choice to sort of have it sort of very sort of muted in tone and sort of very sort of basic in terms of direction for the sort of day-to-day scenes. But then, yeah, I mean, there is a bit more life and colour comes in sort of in the nightclub scenes and the dancing scenes, where you can really see yourself come alive. But I think it's Disobedience, that's another one which I need to watch. Like, a few people have been catching it on social media recently, because I think it's, someone said, come for the Orthodox Jewish drama, stay for Rachel Weisz spitting in Rachel McAdams' mouth. I think I saw that on a tweet somewhere.
yeah, I have also seen that tweet as well. So yeah, I think it's on Amazon Prime in the UK at the moment. But what did you make of John Turturro and his performance as Arnold? He is definitely a very infuriating character, to say the least.
Well, I think he's another actor who I always rate very highly. He's, you know, fantastic in The Big Lebowski and in many of the films. But, you know, he does do a lot of Hollywood blockbuster junk, like the Transformer films as well. So, but I thought he was good. But I think it just felt, I think, maybe a little bit safe, the relationship between the two of them. He never really got the opportunity to sort of really emote. I think, you know, I think part of it was down to the characterization of him being a sort of bit of a wet sad sack of a human being. But, you know, it was clear that he had feelings for Gloria, but, you know, I think he will certainly have done himself no favors with the public by his actions toward the end of the film, I think, which was up there with sort of Ross and Friends, We Were on a Break style of ending a relationship.
Do you think he deserved a paintball shot to the balls?
Absolutely. Yes, you don't walk out on Julianne Moore. I'm sorry.
One thing I think has to be mentioned in this film is the appearance of Sean Astin. What did you make of that very small role from Mr. Astin?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, you had Scott Pilgrim turned up as the son, probably, and then it's like But yeah, no, it's like I was watching the Vegas scene, and then I was like, is that Samwise Gamgee? I think it is. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to go somewhere. And then it was over. And then I was like, oh, okay. I don't know if that was a subplot that got cut or something, but it was just a really random thing to have someone like Sean Astin appear for maybe sort of 2-3 minutes. And I don't think he really had any dialogue whatsoever.
No, it's one of those definitely weird ones where you're kind of watching the cinema thinking, I had the same reaction as you. It's like, huh, what's going on here? And then it's sort of like, yeah, oh, he's been and gone. It was quite a short appearance. So, yeah, I think he could have been in the running for probably a Best Supporting Actor nomination, I think. But it was probably just a tough year.
Yeah.
So, any kind of final thoughts on Gloria Bell?
It's definitely worth a watch for Julianne Moore's performance, I think. Certainly in, like, the final scene where she's at the wedding and she goes up for that dance and then loses herself, and it, her face tells the entire story, and it proves just why she's an incredible actress. But, you know, come for the sort of safe romantic drama, stay for the banging soundtrack.
Yeah, definitely one for maybe sort of an older crowd that don't often see themselves represented in film. And as I say, I think for the rest of us, we get an enjoyable, well-acted, you know, solid film. And I think the way people are burning through films across all platforms just now, maybe people do need a bit of Gloria Bell in lockdown.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing about it, I suppose, is also the fact that it, you know, it has a proper, it shows a proper relationship, and, you know, to older people still enjoying their sex life and actual sex, as opposed to using any sort of box, which we're going to get onto in a couple of minutes, I think.
Yeah, so moving on to High Life. So Monty and his baby daughter are the last survivors of a damned and dangerous mission to the outer reaches of the solar system. They must now rely on each other to survive as they hurtle towards the oblivion of a black hole. Co-written and directed by Claire Denis and starring A24 regular, or friend of A24, I think it's safe to say, Robert Pattinson. What did you make of High Life the first time you saw it, and what were your kind of expectations going into this one?
I mean, I was really looking forward to it, I think, the first time around, because of the Robert Pattinson resurgence. Ever since he started working with A24, the film looked intriguing. I'm a big sci-fi fan, so, you know, I like Moon and all that sort of thing, so sort of isolation in space, you know, absolutely appeals to me. I think we watched it together, the cameo, and I don't know if it was because I'd seen Aniara sort of that year as well, that in terms of sort of female directed film set in space about missions that go awry, it wasn't as good as that one, but it just didn't really click for me overall, and I wasn't really sure why. I mean, it seemed, it was well sort of acted, I liked the stylistic of it, it just, I think certainly on the first time around, it had a very slow pace, and there wasn't, you know, we were just talking about how in terms of Gloria Bell, you know, there wasn't much sort of narrative plot sort of driving it forward. You know, you could argue the same was for here, but I don't know if it was just the pacing or something, but something that just didn't really work for me first time round. But I may have changed my opinion on second time round. What about yourself?
I also sort of changed my opinion the second time around with it. I remembered sort of seeing it the same day as you, and I'd just come from a really good pizza. It was a later than kind of usual kind of screening time for me, so usually I'm a bit sleepier at night time. And I remember just sort of watching it, and just, I'd been really excited for this one. I think, did it come out sort of early kind of last year? I'm thinking the UK wise, because I remember it made a huge kind of impact in Toronto in 2018. And then I was really surprised that it didn't appear at the London Film Festival. So, yeah, it kind of seemed to be just a dragged out release, and I think finally got to see it.
I think it was May, because I think it was the night before we went on our Avengers road trip, wasn't it? So I think it was around about early May it eventually got a UK release.
That's right, yeah. So it's one of those ones, I had a lot of hype and thing, and I'm always looking for original kind of sci-fi films. So I think that first time I caught it, I just wasn't in the right frame of mind. I had a pizza belly, I was tired. It just wasn't all clicking just with me on that first watch, because I wasn't in the right frame of mind. But there was a lot of things I liked about it and admired. It was just one of those ones I thought, I just wasn't quite right for me. But I was the same as you, I think, here. When I caught it for the second time last year, I think it had arrived on I think it was like a 99 cents rental or something on iTunes USA that weekend. I thought, you know what, I'm going to give it another go. And I must say, I really, it clicked more on that repeat. And I'm curious, what was your repeat viewing like, and how much did it sway your mind?
I mean, I just rewatched it a couple of days ago, so it's sort of fresh in the mind. And I think, sort of looking back on it now, it's certainly, I enjoyed it more. I think I rated it 2 stars when I first saw it. I think I would bump it up to 3. It's still not a fantastic film for me, but I certainly appreciated it more sort of second time around. I think I could see a bit clearer what she was going for. I know that she was going through some personal loss, I think, at the time, and while she was directing it, so it did I think it did influence the sort of melancholy and sadness of it. But I mean, I think it sort of came across to me sort of almost as like, I don't know if it's having been on lockdown and sort of watching a lot of these sort of reality shows, but it was almost like one of those, I think there's a new one coming out called Too Hot to Handle, where it's about a bunch of people who are
only one episode away from watching the end of that.
Okay, because yeah, it's like these people who are on a desert island, like Love Island, but the rule is they're not allowed to touch or anything like that. And it sort of struck me rewatching High Life after seeing the trailer for that. That's essentially what they're doing. You know, they're not allowed to. Their prisoners have been basically said, "You're going to go on death row. You're going to get killed. Otherwise, you can volunteer to go up in space." Pretty much never return home in advanced future science, and therefore they go, but they're not allowed to have sex with each other. They use the F box, and also use cups in order to provide samples for Juliet Binoche's doctor to try and work on artificial insemination. I know, sort of reading up on the film as well, they were like, the idea was to basically produce children to sort of further the mission, because depending on how long it takes, everyone might die and they need new people in order to carry on the mission, which I found quite interesting. And also, in some ways, that idea was almost probably better executed than Passengers, which is a 5-star film potential, unfortunately, in about a 1-star film in execution. I could do an entire episode on Passengers and how, if they just tweaked the way it was told slightly, you could have had a fantastic film. It just didn't work on that one. But that's for a different podcast. This is for this one. But I mean, it was really strong performances from Robert Pattinson. I think I got a sense of his motivation and the daughter's motivation and stuff like that. And I certainly appreciated it a lot more. It's still not a 5-star film, but I certainly appreciated it a lot more. What about yourself?
Yeah, the repeat viewing, I think because it was that kind of late at night screening, I wasn't sort of following, I just wasn't maybe as bright on that screen, but I wasn't sort of following the kind of split timelines at the time. And I was just on that sort of repeat view, and I was able to just sort of sit down and just follow through things, just kind of watch how things unfolded. And I thought it was a really well-crafted kind of film. And I think the fact that it's a sci-fi original movie with a concept that I think is pretty well executed for $8 million, I thought was really well done. I thought Pattinson was great. I thought Mia Goth is continuing to be one of my kind of favorite actresses, and it's just filled with Juliet Binoche really embraces this character, and certainly doesn't leave anything on the floor for this one. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I think there's more that I admired and picked up and liked on that repeat viewing, and I just thought it made for like a really good original sci-fi movie, and that's sorely lacking these days, where it seems to be kind of, if you want to make a sci-fi film, it's pretty much going to be kind of a big franchise one. So yeah, I certainly appreciated High Life, and I recently had the chance on this show to interview Claire Tran, who plays Mink as one of the prisoners on the ship. So let's kind of go behind the scenes a little bit on the making of the movie with Claire.
Done 3 films with Claire. What is it that she saw in you and you saw in her that have kind of has this kind of working relationship kind of continuing on?
Well, what I saw in her is, I mean, a hugely talented filmmaker. We say cineaste in France because, yeah, she's more than just a director. She writes and she makes and she directs everyone, and she She has a lot of integrity. That's one of the qualities I love in her, is that she's very, very true to what she believes in, and she never makes any, she never bends. So that's one of her great qualities, and I think that we found in each other a lot of integrity, and she's very direct and truthful, which I appreciate. And what did she like in me? You'd have to ask her. I have no idea. I don't know. I mean, probably the fact that I was a dancer. I have to admit, a lot of directors find it interesting to work with dancers because we have interesting bodies, and that we're quite relaxed with our bodies. And Claire knows how to film bodies. She's all about that. So I don't know. We just clicked and we became friends. So I guess she saw something in my personality that would work in her world.
When did you sort of get the first hint from her about High Life? This was going to be our first sort of fully English language feature. Did you sort of have to audition for the film, or did she say, I've maybe got a role here, are you interested? How did sort of High Life come around for you two?
She talked to me about it. She knocked on my door saying, hey, I'm working on a new film. I'm writing it. It's in English, and I'd like you to read it. So that's the first thing she said to me. But she literally did knock on my door, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll read it. And I didn't, at that time, she didn't speak of a role. She just said, I'd like you to read it. So I wasn't getting my hopes too high, but I was kind of hoping. I read it. I found it astonishing, really very interesting, very mysterious. And it was sci-fi, so I was completely, it was very, very surprising to read a sci-fi piece, knowing that she was going to direct it, and in English. But I read it. I wrote an email to her saying, wow, this is amazing, I want to be in it. So I did kind of say, I want to be in it. And then no news for a long time. And then she came back to me saying, I'd like you to play Mink. And that was a long time ago, because she worked on this film before it was produced for years and years. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to put together. It was only greenlit a few weeks before we started shooting, to be honest. Yeah. So I knew about High Life maybe, gosh, we shot in 2017, and I had known about this film maybe 2 years before. And when she said, oh, I want you to play Mink, I was like, oh, yes, of course, I'd love to. I accepted straight away. And then there was another, at least a year before it was actually greenlit, and she said, we're going to shoot in, it was August.
What was the kind of creative process like for the character of Mink? Did it evolve over those 2 years? And did you sort of have involvement? Because obviously you've clearly been the person she's seen, I want you to be my Mink. Did you sort of get any involvement in helping to develop that character, or was it always sort of from the script?
It was from the script. She was quite sure about she wanted someone young, very young, fragile, kind of like a dainty person, someone quite slim and athletic. So she's like a little monkey, you know, very agile and dynamic. So I think in her mind she wanted someone very athletic. So obviously she knows that I'm a dancer, and she we've worked together, so she knows how I can move. And so that was from the beginning. And then there was questions about the accents, and we decided that my English would be too posh for the role, even though I tried to explain I didn't have a posh accent, it was just RP, but anyway, for French people, I have a posh accent. So we kind of made it into an American, we all had a kind of general American on the film, except for Mia, so that was the only thing we kind of thought about. And then I did my own backstory. She didn't really tell me about Mink's past, so I made up my own story and I went along with it on my own. I kind of developed things on my own. She gave me a lot of freedom.
What was that backstory that you created for Mink? And how did you sort of develop it? Was it like mood boards, writing down like a little biography? How did you sort of kind of bring Mink to life in your head?
Well, because she hasn't got a lot of dialogue, she was very mysterious, and also being so, you know, violent, I was like, okay, I have to find something that motivates so much violence because it can't come out of nowhere, and they are in and out of space, so how did she get there, and how come she's so aggressive? I wrote a biography. I kind of wrote down, you know, what her story was. Why was she in jail in the first place? What did she do? And I kind of gave her an age. Because it was written in the script that she was so young, I decided she... In the spaceship, I would have... I can't remember. Maybe she was a teenager, like 19. But then she would have committed her crimes when she was a child, like 10-ish. So very, 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 very young as a child, which is freaky.
What kind of crimes did you sort of have her penciled down as having committed?
Well, I kind of decided, this is very weird to talk about this, but I decided that if she was on death row at 10 years old, she must have done something horrendous. And because she's so violent, I imagined that she started killing her schoolmates. Mm. She just kind of like, yeah, did this mass murder thing in schools. Like in America, they just start shooting people. And I imagined something horrible. Like she just freaked, like in video games, started killing people. Maybe not with a gun, because that would have been really weird, but just killing her schoolmates and then death row.
I can almost imagine a sort of We Need to Talk About kind of Kevin sort of style prequel filming.
Totally a sociopath. Yeah.
What's it like as an actress to tap into sort of like with Mink, these really violent urges and aggressive scenes that she's in? What's that like for you to kind of get into that headspace? How do you prepare for those scenes?
It's a bit scary. I hate violence. I'm not a violent person. And when I read all the killings and all that, I was like, oh gosh, am I going to be able to do this? I'm a quiet person. So I don't know. We did a bit of training with a guy for stunts. So we did like trained for like fighting and a bit of stunts. So that helped, because having a few tools made it, for me as a dancer, made it feel like I was doing choreography. So, of course, I made it very physical. And when it goes through the body, it makes it easier for me. Because if you think about what you're doing, you can't do it. I mean, killing someone is just unthinkable. So I made it like a choreography. And I made it feel like I was performing a show, really. And then as for the acting, I don't know, you just get so carried away. It all goes very fast. And we didn't do many takes. So you build up something. I mean, Mink was, I think, the quiet one for a long time in the spaceship. And because she was so young, she didn't have a lot to say. She didn't have her word. So I made it feel like she was so frustrated. It was bubbling inside, and then, pah, it kind of exploded. So it was like a frustration building up thing.
With the film, like, Denise obviously assembled this incredible cast alongside yourself. You've got Robert Pattinson, Juliette Binoche, Andre Benjamin, Mia Goth, and you're all bound together on this small spaceship for years. Did you just get time to prepare together to play these prisoners or was it sort of trying to build that up while you were shooting?
Oh, well, we were shooting in a studio, so we were like, and we were in the same hotel, so we were always together, nearly 24/7. So it wasn't difficult to make it feel like we were living in a spaceship, because we practically were. And we were in Cologne, so we were in Germany, and we were not German. So it felt like we were strangers in a strange country, and every day shooting in this, you know, in this decor. And we have our meals together. It felt like we were convicts in a way.
Yeah.
But was quite natural, actually, just being together, hanging out together. And we spent a lot of time prior to the shooting reading. We did table reads and rehearsing. We did talk a lot about the script together, with and without Claire. We'd talk about it in the evenings, like, we had concerns, not concerns, but we had questions, because it was all so mysterious. Mm. I remember having a lot of conversations with Mia and Rob, and just like, what do you think about this? And what about this? And what do you think about this? And how is this possible? And we were picking our brains to kind of, you know, make sense of all this. So it made it very, how do you say, in French we'd say collégial, like a, yeah, it was a group, a think tank, like a group. And we were all kind of trying to make this, make sense of it together.
What's that first day like on set when you're now on this spaceship, you're in your little space suits and outfits? Is it easy to transport yourself to think, we're not in Cologne anymore, we're in the future near a black hole?
Yeah, definitely. Because, because the set was all ready. What really helped was the lighting. And I think all the, because there's this very special lighting inside of the spaceship. And like, when it's nighttime, it goes all blue. And during the daytime, it's white. And then, so it was very dramatic in that way. It felt like we were on stage, actually. And it was quite easy to feel like we were in a spaceship, because it was, you know, really quite immersive and long days. And because it was in a studio, we hardly even went outside, because we were at inside the studio, we were in the canteen next door. So it really felt like we were kind of indoors all day.
What was that scene like? You're bound to your bed, as kind of Mink is watching sort of one of her kind of fellow friends on sort of this spaceship be sexually assaulted. You know, it's one of the most intense scenes sort of within the film. You know, it's very physical, it's very active, there's a lot of aggression and pain kind of going on. What was it like to be involved in that scene, to kind of partake in something like that? How did sort of Claire direct it, and what was it like for you to take part in?
It was a big scene. I was quite nervous about it, because we didn't know how it was going to, you know, play out, because we hadn't rehearsed it. We kind of rehearsed on sets, but we hadn't rehearsed it beforehand. So it was a bit stressful. It all happened quite fast. We did some mechanic rehearsals, like, you're going to be here, Mia's going to be here, and we did it without the camera first to see who was going to do what, how Ewan was going to, what movement he was going to do coming in, because it was a very small space. What you have to know is that the bunk beds were like not even 1 meter apart, so it was a very small cell, so that made it feel really real. So we had to be able to move around with the camera, and so it was tricky. So we rehearsed on set a few times, like, you're going to do this, I'm going to do this, the camera's going to come out. And then it all happened. Suddenly, it had to be real. We got attached, and we were attached with real plastic thingies. It wasn't soft at all, so it really hurt. That helped. So it all became pretty real, and Ewan really was the trigger to the whole scene, because he was amazing, and he went straight to the point. And Claire asked him to take his shorts off, and he said yes. It wasn't really, we didn't know if it was planned or not, but she kind of like asked him on set, and he said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And that made things really, it was real. So he came in, and we knew we couldn't do like 10 takes. So we just kind of jumped into it. And it was freaky. It was really scary, because he was really scary. And then we just all played along. It was rehearsed, but what people were going to actually do, what people's reactions were, how Mia was going to react, was pretty much improvised, you know. And we just had to make sure that no one gets hurt, because there was a lot of punching and hitting and stuff. And we did a separate take for when Ewan punches me in the head. But it was amazing. I didn't know how it was going to be. It was all very chaotic.
Is it an exciting thing when you get a moment like that where, you know, you get your first, your take, all this sort of rage and anger, and you get the climax of that scene as you take out this, you know, terrible individual? Is there something kind of rewarding about that as an actress, to be able to dive into to a scene like that?
Oh yes, definitely. It's very, very it was exhilarating, really, to be able to be a bit, you know, like the savior, and also to be able to get revenge, because I think she had so much going on and she was so bottled up. That was really, she needed to unleash, and there was the perfect moment. And I think the moment where Ewan attacks Mia is really the moment where she's, okay, this is like one too much, because she has a special bond with Mia, and it felt really good. Also because Mia and I became friends on set. Mm. Seeing that happen to her actually really made me mad, and it was so realistic, to be honest. I mean, he was amazing. It wasn't hard to feel that anger and that rage, and it felt really good, actually, yeah, to get to kill him in the end.
Those kind of violent urges return in the later on in the film, and yeah, sort of that bond with Mia Goth's character, as sort of you assault Dibs, and then ultimately you get, you know, you're sort of come up in, sadly, with a spade to the face. What was that kind of scene like, again, that you get to tap into sort of that violent moment, and it ultimately is your betrayal, really, in the end?
Well, that scene, we filmed that actually quite to the end, so I had time to think about it, and we did that late in the evening. It was quite late, so I was tired, and it was a very peaceful moment, and Claire gave me some time to, you know, get into the mood. And I remember I was alone in the corridor. There's a big corridor in the spaceship, and I was like alone. They were all in the room, Rob and Juliette, and they had the camera and everything, and they were kind of doing their thing. And I got a moment to prepare on my own in the corridor. And I think, it more than anger, it was sadness. You're right, because you know, Boise was dead, and so I was grieving. It was more like a grieving thing than an anger thing. It was like, I have nothing to lose now. My best friend has gone. We're all gonna die. This is bullshit. I'm gonna kill her. But it was motivated by sadness.
What was it like to, you know, I always think of it as an actor, you always want a really good death scene, a memorable one. You get that in this film. Everyone gets a great death scene, I think, in this film. What was it like for yours to be on the receiving end of being killed by someone like Robert Pattinson?
It was fun, actually. It was really fun, and I was excited about that scene, and I didn't know how she wanted to stage it. But it was fun and physical, and I don't know, but it was all very fast. And, you know, she does die, but, I mean, you don't see my body afterwards, so I guess I was, it was very quick. That's what I can say.
It's the classic, in space, no one's ever truly dead in science fiction.
But, yeah.
What was it sort of, when kind of the film kind of came to an end, when was the first time you saw the finished picture, and what was your reaction to it?
I saw it when it showed in Paris for the premiere. I was really stressed out. I hadn't seen anything at all. It was all very secret. And I saw it in the room with the whole audience. I think my dad was there, my agents. Yeah, there were a few, you know, relatives and friends come to support the film. And it was very stressful, but also I was very proud. So I was trying to look at the film for what it was and not just kind of like look at myself, because it's horrible to see yourself on screen. Mm-hmm. I honestly hate it. But I was, I wanted George to enjoy the film. The first time was always difficult, so I went to see it again. There were two premieres in Paris, so I got to see it twice. And I was delighted. It was as good as I imagined, and it was very, very moving. I found it moving, especially the end, of course, but seeing what we had done and what she had made out of it, I was proud, and also impressed. I was impressed because she managed to make a Claire Denis film in space, in English, with a huge cast, most of the people she hadn't worked with before, and she made it happen. So I was very impressed by what she did.
What was it sort of like afterwards, as people start having these debates and discussions? The film seemed to just, you know, when it got its kind of big premiere in sort of Toronto, it sort of continued to snowball. You know, I remember sort of it was aired at Toronto and waiting for it to come here to the UK. And there's people talking about these sets. The word fuckbox became part of like mainstream discussion. What's it like to be part of a film that continues to sort of have people talking and debating about big questions of life and have things like, as I say, a fuckbox, etc., where it becomes a new word that feels like it's been added to the dictionary?
Well, yeah, I remember the Toronto thing about, you know, someone being sick in the screening room and like people being horrified, and I was in Paris, so it all seemed quite unreal for me. To I hadn't seen the film, so I didn't know what to think of it. But I was like, oh my gosh, is it that bad? I mean, is it really that hardcore? I was really waiting. It was a big suspense, but I read the critics and all the articles, and it built the excitement, you know, because most of the reviews were really good. I mean, it was a mix. I mean, I read things, critic reviews saying it was a masterpiece, and others saying this is shit, as usual. But I think with a Claire Denis film, that's what you expect, and people hate it or people love it. And it was exciting to see all the things, and you know, the fuck box and this and that, and all the fluids and the sperm and the sex. I found it funny, but I knew what we had done, and I knew that it was all also people like the sex and the violence, and that's what they, you know, they remember. But my take on her film is that it's much more than that, and I knew that it was truly about something else. Mm-hmm. But it made it attractive, you know. I made people want to see it, so it's a good thing. And being part of it is funny, because Toronto, San Sebastian, all the big festivals, I didn't go, so I kind of, I saw that from afar, and I thought it was funny, but I wasn't really into all that. So
yeah, I think do you think we've got a different sensibility here in Europe and France to perhaps like America, where they'll see these things and there's someone throwing up, being sick, whereas we'll go see it and go, that's a new Claire Denis film, yeah, this is like a normal thing on a Tuesday to watch, kind of these attitudes towards sex and kind of the bigger questions in life.
Yeah, the Americans can be, you know, they're easily shocked. I think in France, I mean, probably in the UK too, but in France, I mean, people are so used to Claire Denis films. I mean, they've been there, done that, Trouble Every Day and Beau Travail, all these very sexy films, very physical. And I think our cinema is also a bit different. I mean, very different from even the American indies. I mean, we go in places that Americans won't really go. So I think there was less shock. But then one thing I also realised is that Claire was very famous abroad, and she has a huge fan community in America. Maybe even more than in France. I mean, people know her in France as an auteur, and she's very, you know, arrêté. But she's not mainstream at all. I mean, if you ask a, you know, a high school student, do you know Claire Denis? They won't know her. So it's quite niche.
It seems, I think of it when like High Life came out, there's this brand called Girls on Tea that releases t-shirts of kind of filmmakers and talent, and Claire Denis became one of the names they put on a t-shirt.
Really?
Yeah. I'll email you a link. And at film festivals and so on, kind of at London, Edinburgh, places I've seen, the Claire Denis t-shirt is incredibly popular and so on, and people just went, it's just her name in black writing, you can kind of kick it around. So I think there's definitely something there that she seems to sort of, you know, done so well, kind of, for, you know, you think of some French filmmakers, they never sort of seem to break out of Europe. For her, she seems to have kind of broken into the mainstream, to the fact that she's on a t-shirt, people are paying 20 quid just to have her name on their t-shirt.
Yeah, because I think she's really, she's she represents French independent cinema, art house cinema. I think she's really abroad. That's what, I mean, people, cinephiles know her name and know her films. I mean, I guess cinephiles have all seen one or two of her films. And High Life being, you know, Robert Pattinson starring in High Life definitely helped widen her audience. But yeah, it's she's very famous in cinephile, you know, circles abroad, and I mean, knowing there's a t-shirt, I definitely have to get one. But and actually, I met a guy in France. He's a journalist, cinema critic, and he has a tattoo. It doesn't say Claire Denis, but he has a tattoo of something, a verbatim, something that she said, or that's in one of her movies. I have to get a picture of that tattoo. But that's, he's awesome. A huge. That's awesome.
Cool. So kind of like looking back on your High Life experience, what was your one favorite kind of takeaway moment or memory from being involved in this project?
Oh gosh, there's so many. Some truly lovely moments were when we trained at the Space Center. We all went to the ESA, European Space Agency, to do some training. So we got to, well, first of all, visit the whole place and speak to some astronauts. We had a conference with Tim Peake, so that was
that's
really
amazing.
Cool.
Like, just when I think I'm more jealous, oh, you get to go there. Oh, you get to be an astronaut. You get to be
No, it was pretty cool meeting Tim Peake and hearing, you know, his story and what it's like to be in, you know, in a spaceship. And we met the French astronaut, whose name I just forgot. I'll get back to that in a second. But just being in the Space Center, getting to train, to do some exercises, and that was really fun. And we did it all together. There was Robert, Mia, Juliet, Gloria was there, Ewan, everyone was there. And so that was a bit like being on summer camp. And the other parts I really liked was, well, first day on set. That's always very memorable. Just discovering the whole set and being, you know, realizing, oh, it's actually going to happen, because I'd known about this film for so long. As there was a point where I didn't even think it was going to happen. And actually, on first day, on day one, when you know put on your little suits, it's really cool. I can't remember, though, on first day, we weren't wearing our space suits for the first day. We were in our, like, just convict suits. But it was thrilling, really. So first day on sets, and last day on sets was super fun, because it was the day where my last day was when Robert had to chuck me out of the spaceship. And so that was a bit scary, because it was a pretty big high fall.
So there we go. So there's a little bit of the behind the scenes sort of trivia and stories and insight. It certainly sounded like an interesting film to be part of.
Yeah, no, because I think it's with the benefit of hindsight, and that I don't like to look on IMDb or read reviews and stuff before I go in to a film. So it was sort of reading the sort of IMDb trivia and listening to stuff like this before the rewatch, I think, certainly helped increased my appreciation of it. And I mean, I really like the sort of production design. It was a sort of down and sort of dirty, gritty sort of style. It wasn't the sleek, sort of flashy, you know, sci-fi that you used to get. It was very much in the sort of Alien and Moon sort of world. And you know, the fact that they had this sort of seven on the jerseys, so they were all part of Group Seven. And then, you know, he meets another ship down the line that's got all these sort of dogs on it, and there's another potential spin-off story there about what happened with that. I mean, what did you make of that moment where he sort of docks with the other ship? Because have you seen Ad Astra?
Yeah, I have seen Ad Astra.
Because it has one of those things where it detours and visits another ship, and that's a moment which I think the film lost a lot of people. It's very much not in keeping with the rest of the film. But what did you make of that? And it sort of expands the idea of just exactly what was going on with all these sort of ships.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting idea and stuff. And I think it was the idea of what were they all kind of doing out there, and this idea of sort of fertility within a black hole. I would love to sort of, you know, within the vicinity of a black hole, how much money was spent to explore something like that. When you think, was that really where the money should have been invested in, with science and spaceships and so on? But it's one of these ones. You kind of just either go with it, or you just get caught in the weeds of thinking, oh, that wouldn't have been realistic or so on. And I think, you know, I've watched a lot of sci-fi, good, bad, and middling, that have posed, you know, certain questions. And I thought, why would they do that? But I've found that going with it sometimes is just the best way to it, and just letting them, you know, if they can convince me that, you know, they've put the effort in, I'll go along with it.
Yeah, I mean, do we know what Neil deGrasse Tyson has made of this one? I know he worked on Interstellar, but I know that, you know, you've got the daughter that grows up to be a teenager, but Robert Pattinson's just got a bit of grey dusting to his hair. I know that there's the explanation that because they're travelling basically on the outer rim of a black hole, time takes a lot longer there, even though it's the same amount of time, they don't experience it the same way. So I know there's all sorts of scientific mumbo-jumbo as to why things happen in the ways. But, you know, I certainly bought into it. I know it. In Interstellar, they've got something similar where they're on one planet. They think for about a couple of hours and then they come back. It's been about sort of 10, 12 years or something like that. So, you know, it's not a new concept, but I think it certainly is in keeping with the sort of world that they established. And I certainly never questioned any of the science or the reasoning behind all of it. Although the mechanics of that box, there's a behind-the-scenes making of featurette, I think, on that, absolutely.
Yeah, what did you make of the F-box? It was probably one of the most... I'm surprised it didn't get itself as... You know how, like, the Oxford Dictionary always has, like, a word of the year? I am surprised the F-box wasn't the word of that year.
Yeah, no, that was... it was a sequence which certainly justified the rating of High Life, which I think mentioned fluids and stuff like that. It was quite something to watch last thing on a Friday night, I know that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those ones that certainly, you know, generated a lot of discussion and debate, and sometimes you have to get that, I suppose, with these indie movies. Yeah, you can have someone like Robert Pattinson in it that will bring an audience into it, but sometimes you get these kind of controversial scenes where people will go, oh, I'm going to go check that kind of film out. I always think of something like that In the Cut with Meg Ryan, or Basic Instinct, those kind of films where people are maybe checking it out because of something that they've heard buzz about or talk about. And I think something like this can probably bring in a bit of an audience to something like High Life. And if it puts money into an independent movie's coffers, then I'm all for it. And if that means that we get more films like this, then I'm happy to see it. So yeah, it was a good decision. Whether it worked out the way they thought it was, who knows? Or else it was a work of genius, and they knew all along that the F-box would generate a lot of controversy, discussion, and prying eyes. Then well done to Claire Denis and the team.
Well, I mean, controversy and discussion in the UK and US perhaps, but in France, probably wouldn't have even batted an eyelid, to be honest. they love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but everyone in France Poly is now creating their own one in sort of the cupboard or something. Like those that are single, that they're used to the dating apps, all that sort of stuff, they're needing their fix. They're like, you know what? I'm going to turn my cupboard, get the Hoover out there, I'm making my own F-box.
It's a self-isolation project for sure.
Absolutely. Some people do a board game. Some people create their own sex machine. You know, different strokes for different folks, I guess.
Strokes being the appropriate word.
Absolutely. So any final thoughts on High Life?
It's a film which has grown on me, and I certainly have... I've got a better opinion now, but it's even before my rewatch, there was enough in it that made me excited for the, I think, upcoming re-partnership of Claire Denis and Robert Pattinson, and the addition of Margaret Qualley from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well, which I think is going to be A24 as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's definitely something to look out for as well. So we will eventually review that one in, what, 2022? Who bloody knows?
Yeah, they might become monthly or bi-monthly podcasts by that point. Although you've got enough interviews that will probably be able to still be going every week by that point, I think.
I know. Well, as it stands at the moment, the challenge that we face is, so in terms of like a full episode that we can do, will be episode, this is like obviously taking into account every other week we'll have interviews and stuff, will be episode 72, which will be Waves and In Fabric, which will be followed by number 73, which would be Uncut Gems and First Cow, which currently has no UK or US release date. So we should be coming to that one on August 17th. Unlikely. And then followed by that is currently A Solitary Saint Maud just sitting there. So I think I suspect it'll be the TV we'll probably have to turn to fill in our discussions between getting any sort of A24 film content. Who knows?
I guess it gives me an excuse to finally get round to watching Euphoria and stuff like that. So yeah, we might have to sub in the TV series, because I know First Cow, they said that they wanted that to be on the big screen. I'm not sure if it is a big screen film, but you know, good on them. I know we've both seen Saint Maud, so we could do an episode on that, but obviously we'd want other people to be able to see it. So I guess we'll just have to see what where the chips fall by August, I guess.
Yeah, well, Euphoria season one is the equivalent of £7 in iTunes USA right now, highly recommended. Or you can dive into Amazon Prime and watch Comrade Detective, A24's first TV series starring Channing Tatum, which is, you know, very interesting. If you're into something like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, it's definitely worth giving a little view to.
I am into Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Well, there you go, another lockdown watch. But we'll be back next week with Native Son, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with Native Son and Under the Silver Lake. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.